Isaiah, chapters 26 and 27, the 19th talk in a series on Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on July 14, 2013, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're picking up again where we left off in Isaiah. But before I get into chapters 26 and 27, I want to just respond briefly to some questions last week. Last week, I argued that the first six verses of chapter 24 are talking about a worldwide judgment, and that this section, 24 through 27, is kind of a summary to all of the judgments on the various enemies of Judah that were spelled out in the previous 10 chapters. And I was largely steered in that direction by the nature of the wording, talking about the earth, the world, the earth being, its surface being distorted, its inhabitants scattered, etc., etc. But, as I mentioned, the word for world in Hebrew can mean either the earth or the world, or it can mean the land. We have the same problem in Hebrew as there is in the Greek, that the same word does double duty. So, could it have been that this is talking about just Israel rather than the whole world? And that question was raised. Michael and Logan both pointed out that it talks about the earth is in verse 5, the earth is also polluted by its inhabitants, for they transgressed laws, violated statutes, broke the everlasting covenant. And it's that everlasting covenant that makes it sound like it's talking about Israel specifically because of the covenant that was made between God and Abraham. And my response to that was that I think what's in mind here is a different covenant, and that is the covenant that was made between God and Noah. But I had mentioned that it was an implicit covenant rather than an explicit covenant. But I looked back, and I'll read just a few verses in Genesis chapter 9, I think it is. Yes. I'll read the first, I'm going to read the first section, the first half of chapter 9. So just bear with me. This is after the flood. And God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea into your hand they are given. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you, as I gave the green plant. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. And surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it." Then God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, "Now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes out of the ark, even every beast of the earth. And I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood, neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I am making between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth. Now the term that's translated everlasting covenant is the same, that is the same phrase that occurs in Isaiah. So, whereas it's true that the vast majority of occurrences of this phrase, eternal covenant, refer to the covenant to Abraham or his descendants, that is Abraham, Isaac, I think there's one to Jacob, and then one to David, that those all have the term everlasting covenant used. This is the only occurrence, this is the only reference for a covenant that was not made to a descendant of Abraham that is called an eternal or everlasting covenant. So it doesn't prove my case, but at least there is the possibility that eternal covenant refers to this rather than to the agreements made with Abraham and his descendants. Okay, let's look at chapters 26 and 27. Now, as I said, these four chapters, 24 through 27, are all apparently a kind of summing up from the 10 chapters that preceded it, in which God states the judgment that is coming on the enemies of Israel. And now in 24 and through 27, the way I'm seeing it, it's talking about a universal judgment that comes on the enemies of Judah. And in chapters 26 and 27 is primarily praising God for the things that he has done and the things that he will do. This section is difficult, as has most of Isaiah been, but this chapter raises a number of difficult questions, but we'll work our way through it. First six verses. In that day, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. He sets up walls and ramparts for security. Open the gates that the righteous nation may enter. The one that remains faithful, the steadfast of mind, thou wilt keep in perfect peace, because he trusts thee. Trust in the Lord forever, for in God the Lord we have an everlasting rock. For he has brought low those who dwell on high, the unassailable city. He lays it low. He lays it low to the ground. He casts it to the dust. The foot will trample it, the feet of the afflicted, the steps of the helpless. This phrase, in that day, we've seen a number of times already in Isaiah, but in this section it's particularly frequent. I think it shows up 7 times in these 4 chapters. And I think in all of these cases it's talking about the final judgment, the event of the final act. It's point B on Jack's graph, the terrible day of the Lord. And we have a song here that presents an image that is an interesting image. There is a lot of imagery in these chapters. It's sometimes difficult to sort out, and I'll have some comments about that at the end. But the image is of a strong city that this is in the land of Judah, we have a strong city. He sets up walls and ramparts for security. So this is a strong city that God has built. God is the one who has made it strong. And it is as if the righteous nation is just outside the doors of this city and ready to take possession. So we have this shining, new, well-fortified city, and the righteous nation, and I think this is a reference to Judah, but Judah made righteous, or it could be Israel, made righteous, that's standing just outside the gates. And it says, open the gates that the righteous nation may enter. The one that remains faithful. So we're talking about a nation that is characterized by righteousness and by faithfulness. Faithfulness to God. That is, they trust the God who of Israel, the God who is there, the God who has done so much for them. And they realize that he is a faithful and trustworthy God who has made some outstanding, phenomenal promises to them. And the result of that is perfect peace. That those who trust a God who is powerful and good and trustworthy have perfect peace. This is trust in the Lord forever, for in God the Lord we have an everlasting rock. That he is firm and unmoving. He provides an anchor, certainty. And that term rock is used throughout the Old Testament in reference to God. Okay, so that's what awaits the nation of Israel. On the other hand, he has brought low those who dwell on high, the unassailable city. I think here what's primarily in mind is those nations which have historically picked on Israel, the ones who have been Israel's enemies. And I think in particular here we're talking about the city of Nineveh, the city of Babylon, probably. But it's those well-fortified cities that have been the base of operations for nations that have oppressed Israel over the years. And probably the people of Israel would have looked at those cities and they would have said, there is nothing that we can do with respect to them. They are so big. They are so well secured, so well guarded. They are impenetrable. They are impregnable. There is no way that we can do anything about it. We just have to be subject to them and whatever their whims. So those are the cities that have historically been the ones that they have faced and have suffered under. But he lays it low. He lays it low to the ground. He casts it to the dust. So God has devastated those things, destroyed them completely, to such a point that the foot will trample it, the feet of the afflicted, the steps of the helpless. And I think the image here is this country of Israel, which has suffered so much at the hands of these other countries that have conquered them and extracted wealth from them over a long period of time. They're going to be brought down. They're just going to be a pile of rubble. And the feet of the afflicted, those who were oppressed, those who suffered, are going to be able to walk over the top of an area that previously seemed to be unassailable. The feet of the afflicted, the steps of the helpless. So I think that's the image here is Israel, which has suffered at the hands of its oppressors, that situation is going to be undone completely. And those cities that seem to be permanent, fixed in the universe, unassailable, are going to be brought down to rubble. And those who had suffered under them will be able to walk across them. Okay, next section. The way of the righteous is smooth, O upright one. Make the path of the righteous level. Indeed, while following the way of thy judgments, O Lord, we have waited for thee eagerly. Thy name, even thy memory, is the desire of our souls. At night my soul longs for thee. Indeed, my spirit within me seeks thee diligently. For when the earth experiences thy judgments, the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness. Though the wicked is shown favor, he does not learn righteousness. He deals unjustly in the land of the upright and does not perceive the majesty of the Lord. So taking off on the last image that he's created, where we have the helpless and afflicted walking across the ruins of these destroyed, fortified cities. He continues now with the image of a roadway. And he says that the way of the righteous is smooth. O upright one, make the path of the righteous level. So that is, clear the way for the righteous. And I think the idea here is, and O righteous one obviously is a reference to God. God, clear the way for the righteous so that they can go where they need to go. Indeed, while following the way of thy judgments, O Lord, we have waited for thee eagerly. I think the meaning here is that while making our way through God's judgments, and I think that's sorting out good and evil, that it's this picture of people trying to figure out what to do and how to do it in a way that's consistent with God's principles. And that is what the righteous have tried to do. That's what this life has been about for them. And in so doing, we have waited for thee eagerly, that there's eager anticipation of God finally showing himself, finally manifesting himself, finally making things, putting things in order. He says, thy name, even thy memory, is the desire of our souls. And I think what that means is they're counting on the character of God, and I'm taking thy name to be the character of God. They're counting on the character of God and their past history, the memory. The past history is being consistent with who God is. And if we extrapolate from what God's character is and what he's done in the past, we can extrapolate to where he's leading things and what he's going to do. And that is what we're waiting eagerly for, because that will be a good end. At night, my soul longs for thee. Indeed, my spirit within me seeks thee diligently. So there's an intense longing all the time, longing for God to do what's consistent with his character and his past performance. Okay, now this next section is difficult. There is something being contrasted here, and it's not clear exactly what is being contrasted. But I think what's being contrasted is, on the one hand, some people, when they experience God's discipline, his loving discipline, the response is they learn righteousness. But others, even though they're shown not just loving discipline, but they're shown favor, they don't learn righteousness. I think that's the contrast that we have. So on the one hand, it's those who have a heart for God, and I'm taking the inhabitants of the world to be that. I'm taking this to be kind of the generalized proper response, and in that sense, the inhabitants of the world. That when they experience thy judgments, they learn righteousness. Contrasted with those who are wicked at heart, when they are shown God's love, when they're shown favor, they do not learn righteousness. I think that's the contrast that's being made here. It is difficult to sort out. But if that's the case, it's interesting that the contrast that he's making is, as people go through life, if there is a heart for God, they can understand, they can perceive that what's going on in their lives as they proceed through their life and the difficulties that they run into, that there is a good God who is using those experiences to do productive things in their lives. And they can understand it, even if it's unpleasant, even if it's downright excruciatingly difficult, that it's purposeful and is ultimately stems from God's love for them. Whereas, on the other side of the coin, the wicked, just being shown favor, don't respond. They don't learn righteousness. That there's a bitterness that develops and rejection of what God is doing. He not only does not learn righteousness, but deals unjustly in the land of uprightness and does not perceive the majesty of the Lord. Okay, next section. O Lord, thy hand is lifted up, yet they do not see it. They see thy zeal for the people and are put to shame. Indeed, fire will devour thine enemies. Lord, thou wilt establish peace for us, since thou hast also performed for us all our works. O Lord our God, other masters besides thee have ruled us, but through thee alone we confess thy name. The dead will not live, the departed spirits will not rise. Therefore thou hast punished and destroyed them, and thou hast wiped out all remembrance of them. Thou hast increased the nation, O Lord. Thou hast increased the nation, thou art glorified. Thou hast extended all the borders of the land. O Lord, they sought thee in distress. They could only whisper a prayer. Thy chastening was upon them. As the pregnant woman approaches the time to give birth, she writhes and cries out in her labor pains. Thus were we before thee, O Lord. We were pregnant. We writhed in labor. We gave birth, as it were, only to wind. We could not accomplish deliverance for the earth, nor were inhabitants of the world born. Your dead will live, their corpses will rise. You who lie in the dust, awake and shout for joy, for your dew is as the dew of the dawn, and the earth will give birth to the departed spirits. Okay, this is a very difficult passage. But I think what's being contrasted here is, on the one hand, the enemies of Israel, and it talks about their experience, and in particular, they're dead and they will not live. And that is contrasted with Israel. And it talks about the fate of Israel, and it talks about Israel and likens Israel to a pregnant woman who tries to give birth but gives birth only to wind. But then it talks about your dead will live, and the earth will give birth to the departed spirits. Okay. So I think it's contrasting the enemies of Israel and their inability to live, contrasted with Israel, the nation of Israel, and its frustration at producing life, but God's ability, nevertheless, to produce resurrection from the dead, that kind of life. Okay, let's go through it. Verse 11. We have "O Lord" here a number of times in the vocative case. It's your hand is lifted up, yet they do not see it. The "they" is the enemies of Israel, I think. God is ready to take action, but they're oblivious to it. They cannot see that. They see thy zeal for the people and are put to shame. I think that this is talking about God's zeal for the people of Israel. And there's a certain amount of jealousy that they see, that God, acting zealously on behalf of Israel, creates creates jealousy on the part of the enemy nations. They wish they had that kind of assistance, divine assistance. But indeed, fire will devour thine enemies. And fire, I mentioned that last week, fire shows up very often through here. And it's the destruction, it's the final judgment and destruction of wickedness. Okay, so that is the fate of the enemies of Israel. Now Israel, Lord, thou wilt establish peace for us, since thou hast also performed for us all our works. O Lord our God, other masters besides thee have ruled us, but through thee alone we confess thy name. God is going to establish for Israel, on the other hand, not destruction, but peace. How do we know that? Because of all of the other works that God has performed. They are all leading up towards that. There are other masters that have ruled over Israel, and I think that is primarily talking about other gods. So God is not the only one who has been in their midst, but it's through thee alone that we confess thy name, that God alone is the one who has done good by Israel. So that's what stands ahead of Israel. Now, returning back to the enemies, the dead will not live. The disparted spirits will not rise. Therefore, thou hast punished and destroyed them. Thou hast wiped out all remembrance of them. So the enemies, destroyed by fire, they're gone, and they will not rise again. They will not rise from the dead. God has punished them and destroyed them, completely annihilated them and any remembrance of them. Now, returning back to Israel, thou hast increased the nation, O Lord. Thou hast increased the nation. Thou art glorified. Thou hast extended all the borders of the land. And I think that's the basic thing that's being explained here is God has made Israel great, the nation of Israel great. Now, as God was making them great throughout history, I think what it's describing is the people of Israel could not accomplish what God did accomplish. That is to say, the people of Israel could not extend the nation. They could not protect the nation. They could not keep it secure. He says, O Lord, they sought thee in distress. They could only whisper a prayer. Thy chastening was upon them. So in the midst of being disciplined by God, they couldn't say a thing. They could only whisper a prayer. They were as a pregnant woman who's getting ready to give birth, and in fact looking forward to the baby coming, and writhing in pain. But we gave birth, as it were, only to wind, that nothing came of it. We could not accomplish, and then it's deliverance for the earth, but I am suspicious that earth here would be better translated land. We could not accomplish deliverance for the land. That is, we could not protect and save Israel. Nor were inhabitants of the world born. And I'm going to retranslate this one as well. What they've translated born can mean to cause to fall. So it means to be born is to be caused to fall from the mother, to be delivered. So I think here, nor were inhabitants of the world caused to fall. That is, were they defeated? Were they turned back? So I think what he's saying is the people of Israel could not deliver the land, they couldn't save the land, and they couldn't turn back the inhabitants of the earth. But even though Israel could not do that, your dead will live. That is, I think what he's talking about is a second life for Israel. Your dead will live. Their corpses will rise. Those who lie in the dust awake and shout for joy. For your dew is as the dew of the dawn, and the earth will give birth to the departed spirits. So there will be a birth, and it's the rebirth of those who had died. So there will be a resurrection. So what they could not do is save Israel with all of their efforts. But what will happen is Israel will be saved. Israel will be rebirthed. Okay, next section. Come, my people, enter into your rooms and close your doors behind you. Hide for a little while until indignation runs its course. For behold, the Lord is about to come out from his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. And the earth will reveal her bloodshed and will no longer cover her slain. In that day, the Lord will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, with his fierce and great and mighty sword, even Leviathan, the twisted serpent, and he will kill the dragon who lives in the sea. So now it's his advice in response to what's coming. He says to my people, enter into your rooms. Lock yourselves up. Just get out of harm's way. Close the doors behind you. Hide for a little while. He doesn't point out that it might be several thousand years. Until indignation runs its course. So until God's has exercised all of his wrath. Why? Because God is about to move. God's going to come out from his place, and he's going to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity, reveal her bloodshed. God is going to punish Leviathan. Leviathan is the serpent, I think, the serpent and the dragon in Revelation. God is going to punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, with his fierce sword and great and mighty sword. So God is going to destroy the Leviathan. And I think the Leviathan here is evil itself. Even Leviathan, the twisted serpent, and he will kill the dragon who lives in the sea. And I think that sea here is symbolic of that area where evil thrives, and that's chaos, lack of order, lack of law. So that's going to happen. So stay out of harm's way is the advice, which is interesting insofar as what is not stated is not a call to action. It's not that people are being called to participate in this. God's going to do it. God's the one who's going to destroy the Leviathan. Next section. In that day, a vineyard of wine, sing of it. I, the Lord, am its keeper. I water it every moment. Lest anyone damage it, I guard it night and day. I have no wrath. Should someone give me briars and thorns in battle, then I would step on them. I would burn them completely. Or let him rely on my protection. Let him make peace with me. Let him make peace with me. In the days to come, Jacob will take root. Israel will blossom and sprout, and they will fill the whole world with fruit. He's returning now to an image that he used much earlier in Isaiah. He used the image of a vineyard, and he likened Israel to a vineyard, and God planted the vineyard, and he built a fence around the vineyard, and he watered it, and he cultivated, he took good care of it, but it produced bad fruit. And because it produced bad fruit, he tore down the walls, and he stopped caring for it, and he allowed the animals to come in and trample it, and he allowed the briars and the thorns to grow up in it. And he did that as discipline in order to turn Israel around. Now he's using that same image, but there's no more discipline here. He's the keeper. He waters it every moment. He looks out for anything that would happen to harm it. And if anything comes to harm it now, and here the translation is a little bit difficult, but it says, should someone give me briars and thorns in battle? I think what this means is, should anyone try to conflict, join me in conflict, anyone bringing briars and thorns, anyone introducing briars and thorns, I'll take them on, and I will step on them. I will burn them completely. So now if any briars or thorns threaten to do anything to the vineyard, God just is going to wipe them out. Or let them rely on my protection. Let them make peace with me. That's the alternative. So there will be no threat anymore. Any real threat will be destroyed. Any threat that fades away will be reconciled with God. And in that environment, then, Jacob will take root. Israel will blossom and sprout. And they will fill the whole world with fruit. Next section. Like the striking of him who has struck them, has he struck them? Or like the slaughter of his slain, have they been slain? Thou didst contend with them by banishing them, by driving them away. With his fierce wind, he has expelled them on the day of the east wind. Therefore, through this, Jacob's iniquity will be forgiven. And this will be the full price of the pardoning of his sin. When he makes all the altar stones like pulverized chalk stones, when Asherim and incense altars will not stand. For the fortified city is isolated, a homestead forlorn and forsaken like the desert. There the calf will graze, and there it will lie down and feed on its branches. When its limbs are dry, they are broken off. Women come and make a fire with them, for they are not a people of discernment. Therefore, their Maker will not have compassion on them, and their Creator will not be gracious to them. This first verse is very difficult to translate and get it to work out right, but the idea, I think, is clear. What he's saying is, did God strike them, that is, his people? Did God strike them in discipline? Did he strike them the way that a God would strike them who wants to wipe them out? Did God treat them that way? And the answer is no. God contended with them by banishing them, by driving them away. His fierce wind expelled them on the day of the east wind. He drove them out, but he didn't strike them with the kind of striking that destroys. And Jacob's iniquity will be forgiven because of this. Through this disciplining rather than destroying, Jacob's iniquity will be forgiven. He will be pardoned. And the price of that pardon is going to be the destruction of the altar stones and the Asherim and the incense altars, that all of those things that were used to worship the other gods will have to be pulverized. And that will be the price of the pardoning. So that's what's going to happen to Israel. But the fortified city, where is it? It's isolated. It's like a deserted homestead out in the prairie. There the calf will graze, and there it will lie down and feed on its branches. There's nothing there but a calf lying down and eating the branches of a tree. The fortified city is of no value now. And then he switches images. We just had a calf eating the branches of a tree in this desolated area. Now going from that tree, when its limbs are dry, they are broken off. Women come and make a fire with them. So the image now is these tree branches, when they die and fall off, women just come along and pick those up and use it for firewood. Once again, a burning. Why? For they are a people of discernment. They are not a people of discernment. Therefore, their maker will not have compassion on them, and their creator will not be gracious to them. So that's their fate. Okay, the last section. And it will come about in that day that the Lord will start his threshing from the flowing stream of the Euphrates to the brook of Egypt. And you will be gathered up one by one, O sons of Israel. It will come about also in that day that a great trumpet will be blown, and those who were perishing in the land of Assyria and who were scattered in the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. So in that day, and so in the end, God is going to, it says start his threshing, but that same word can be used for harvesting olives, and I think that's probably the image here. That God will begin his harvesting of olives, starting from the flowing stream of the Euphrates to the brook of Egypt. So starting at the north of Israel and working his way all the way down to the south of Israel. And he's going to beat the trees with sticks. Apparently that's the way they harvested olives. Beat the trees with sticks and get the olives to fall. And then he's going to gather them up one by one, which is interesting. It's a very discriminating way of harvesting the olives. So he's going to gather them all up, and at the same time, a great trumpet will be blown, and those who were perishing in the land of Assyria and those who were scattered in the land of Egypt will come and worship the Lord in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. So he's harvesting all of his people from Israel, but he's also calling them from the other ends of the inhabited world, and they will all come and worship the Lord on the holy mountain at Jerusalem. Okay. This whole section can be read as a contrast between the enemies of Israel and Israel and the fates that await them. If it's taken in this way, then there is a sense in which this, what is talked about here, was realized by the time of Christ. That is to say, Israel and Judah had both been removed into exile, and Judah had come back, had returned from exile. Its main opponents, Assyria and Babylon, had both been destroyed as kingdoms and never to arise again. So there's a sense in which, by the time of Christ, this scenario that's being described on one level has been carried out. But if that's what Isaiah had in mind, it seems to me that the language is overstated. That there's a lot of talk about the righteous versus the wicked. There's talk about corpses rising from the dead. There's talk about the dragon being killed. And all of those seem to hearken to a bigger event, a more final event. So I really think that this passage has a more full referent, that if Isaiah were pressed, this is really about the end rather than the historical events surrounding Assyria and Babylon prior to the time of Christ. I think it's talking about a final judgment in which the enemies of Israel, that is the whole world of it virtually, will be destroyed. And the nation of Israel will literally be raised from the dead. There's another theme in these four chapters that is also there, and that is that the oppressed will no longer be at the mercy of the oppressors. Now, usually when it's talking about, uses words that refer to this relationship between the oppressors and the oppressed, it's talking about Israel as the oppressed and its enemies as being the oppressors. However, I think that there are some hints that it's also referring to that relationship within Israeli society, and I take the first section of chapter 24 to be suggesting that it's not one nation oppressing another, but it's individuals oppressing other individuals. And that ultimately, in the end, there will be some social leveling. That is, those distinctions will be destroyed. Those distinctions between those in power and those who are powerless and at the mercy of those in power, those distinctions will be eradicated, done away with forever. But as I've thought about this, it gets more complicated in that the equation of the oppressed with the righteous and of the oppressors with the wicked, it seems to me is not very tight in our reality. That is to say, there are many oppressed people who, by the biblical definition, are wicked. And there are many people in positions of power who are, by the biblical definition, righteous or just. So that equation is not very tight. It seems to me that there is a complex of images that are actually at work here. And Isaiah draws upon all of them. And that is, it is literally true that Israel will be saved by God, and the enemies of Israel will be destroyed. That will be a historic fact in the end of time. It is also true that the oppressors, the relationship that has made it possible for some people to be oppressed by the oppressors, that dynamic will be destroyed and gone. But I think that there's a more fundamental reality that is being talked about here, and that is the relationship between us as individuals and evil will be undone. That is, the ultimate oppressor is evil. That the enemies of Israel are just kind of standing in for evil itself. Oppressors are just kind of standing in for evil itself. They are analogous to the relationship that we have with evil. And that ultimately, we will no longer be subject to evil, sin, suffering. And that the relationship between Israel and its enemies and the oppressors and the oppressed is just kind of capturing that greater reality that's going to change at the end of time. A couple weeks ago, a fellow that I have not talked to for, what would it be, about 40 years, called me. Is somebody that I went to high school with, and so we went and had coffee, and it was fun. And he caught me up on what had happened to him since he disappeared after high school, and I caught him up on what has happened to me, and that has got me to thinking a little bit about my past. I haven't thought much about my childhood, but I guess when I get to my age, it's time to do that. But in thinking about this passage, I was thinking about my experience in grade school and junior high and high school. When I was in grade school, we lived in Klamath Falls, and I was not really aware of a pecking order in my experience in grade school. There probably was one, but I was oblivious to it. I didn't really recognize it or see it happening. And in Klamath Falls, if I think that if you were to rank us in the pecking order, that I would have been relatively high. That is to say, I was relatively popular at that time. But then we moved to Salem when I was, and I think I was in the fifth grade, moved to a school I'd never been before, didn't know anybody there. And that was a difficult experience. And my ranking fell considerably. I was right down at the bottom of the pecking order when we moved to Salem. And that was difficult. And I spent a lot of time thinking about what is this? What is this popularity thing, and how does it work, and all that, and why is it so miserable for those that aren't in the popular group? Then I was only in that grade school for a year and a half, and then went to junior high school. And in junior high school, I think I raised in the pecking order a little bit. I probably was a little bit below average. So that was considerably better, and was there for 3 years, and then went to high school, and I suspect I moved up slightly to maybe average or slightly above average, and that was a little bit better. And then I went to college, and it kind of all disappeared. I mean, I went to a college where nobody knew me. I was starting all over. They didn't know how unpopular I was, so they didn't stay away from me. And so it was a whole different experience, and there wasn't really the same kind of pecking order anyway. College was just too big. And so that, it just kind of disappeared as a phenomenon in my thinking. But if you had told me in the sixth grade that this will all go away, I wouldn't have believed you. I mean, it seemed like a reality that was built into the structure of the universe, that you will be on the bottom rung. That's just the way it is. And it really seemed that way, and it seemed like there was nothing I could do about that fact. And I remember talking to my kids, and I kept saying, and they had some of those same struggles. I think middle school is probably the worst, and high school's next to worst. But I told them, none of this stuff will matter. And this, when you graduate from high school, none of this stuff will matter. When you go to college, it won't matter. But they didn't believe me either. I mean, it's so hard to believe that when you're in the midst of it. It seems like that's just the way it is. It always will be. I think that's what Isaiah is talking about here. It seems like the oppressed will always be oppressed. It seems like it's just built into the nature of the universe that it will always be that way. It seems like the big empires will always be the big empires, and we in Israel will always suffer at their hands. And Isaiah is saying it is not built into the structure of the universe that be so. In fact, it's going to be undone. And that is just analogous to the bigger thing that will be undone, and that is we will not always be subject to evil, to our sinfulness, to pain and suffering. That will all be undone. It will all disappear. It's all an illusion that is permanent and fixed. And that I find very encouraging. That's a helpful image for me that I think that Isaiah is building here. Okay, questions or comments?
Some of the imagery in the first four verses of 27. Uh-huh. One thing that came to mind when it said, slay the dragon that is in the sea. If I'm not mistaken, really until Roman times, sea travel was just pretty much a crapshot. I mean, there was storms and specifically pirates and so on. And Romans were the first really to deal with pirates. And I'm just wondering if there's some more further imagery of that type of the sea is like a no man's land, or it's, I don't know if I can explain it, mm-hmm. that it's just, mm-hmm. and if I'm thinking one thing, that Leviathan, at least as it's expressed in many ancient cultures and so on, is really an expression of this unknownness, this fear, like there's got to be something out there that's doing all this to the ships and so on. That's why there's... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that image actually goes way back, because I'm taking my cues from Genesis. That how does creation start? I mean, what are things like before God begins his creative activity? Well, it's dark, and there's waters, the waters over the face of the earth, and the depths, the Tehom. And that is related to the Babylonian, the Tiamat, who is the god of the depths, the god of the waters. And I think what happened is, certainly in Hebrew culture, the water was an inhospitable place. They were not a seagoing people. And so the waters is that place that is uninhabitable to man. It's just, we can't live there. It's incompatible with us. And I think that's what, in Genesis, what's happening is it's moving from that which is absolutely uninhabitable to man and is chaotic and dark to something that is habitable to man, that's well set up for man, where he is well furnished. It's got order. It ends with the dry land, and God makes man and places him on the dry land. So I think that the seas are symbolic of that which is incompatible with human existence. It's chaos, it's darkness, it's inhospitable. And I think this is picking up from that.
Thank you. And verse 4, when it says briars and thorns against me in battle, the imagery that came to my mind is in Revelation, where the field that is set up with the wheat, and that there's the tares and so on. Mm-hmm. I just find it kind of interesting to what is with the, I guess you'd say, the plant motive going to battle. Mm-hmm. Now, is this simply because he's talking about a vineyard and taking what is probably maybe the most...
the biggest threat.
Evil, most threatening to the vineyard.
I think that's what's happening. Now, why he says in battle,
yes, that.
I'm not sure. That's, it's like he's got this image of the vineyard that's being encroached upon by the thorns, but then he leaves his picture and talks about it happening in battle. That I'm not sure exactly what to do with that.
Okay.
Actually, they would be used as weapons in battle.
Hmm.
You would set up obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these guys are walking around in sandals and their mm-hmm. skivvies, basically. They're mm-hmm. kilts. And you build, well, it's like the kraal they use when they want to keep their cattle in Africa. Mm-hmm. They just gather up all the thorns within reach, and they weave them together, mm-hmm. and they build a thorn wall. And I think he's just saying, I'll just walk right over it. It's not going to bother me. I don't worry about those things anymore. But my question is, if I'm sitting here listening to Isaiah, reading this in the marketplace or whatnot, I mean, I'm hanging on his every word, and all of a sudden it hits me, why are you telling us this? How would you answer that?
That's in the next chapter.
He keeps them coming back.
It is very interesting.
Okay. I mean, why, yes. why this? Why now? Okay. You know, why us? Okay.
That in the next chapter, he anticipates his listeners asking that very question, and he refuses to answer. I really think what he's trying to do is kind of step back and give them the whole sweep of history, because you can't understand a year, a decade, a century. You can't understand that chunk without having the picture, the bigger picture, because I've thought about the phenomenon that we were in Santa Barbara, and in Santa Barbara, there is coastline that runs, it runs backwards. It runs, the coastline, it comes down and then it sweeps in and then back out. So you've got coastline running north as you're going south. And I was thinking, you know, all coastlines like that. You can't tell which way it's running if you look at a little chunk. You have to look at the whole thing. And that's the way history is. You can't tell what's going on by looking at one century in the history of Israel. The only way you can tell what's happening is if you look at the whole thing and where things are going. And Isaiah is saying, let's look at the whole thing. And if you look at the whole thing, we're headed for someplace that's phenomenal. And the things that you're experiencing right now, it looks like you will be living in misery forever. But it's not true. There is a time coming that will be glorious. Keep that in perspective. Don't allow yourself to be seduced by what's happening right now to make it, to commit yourself to various things out of desperation to other gods or whatever, out of desperation, because you will be acting on something that's very temporary. So I think that's basically what he's doing. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. What you just said is that everything looks scary at first right now, but just be faithful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just over and over again, just be faithful.
Right.
You know, don't worry about this monster, or that dragon, or
right.
this drought, or whatever. It's just be faithful. Right. I'll care for you.
And the problem is that can sound absolutely empty, unless you really understand where things are going and you trust in that map of where things are going. And that's what Isaiah is trying to do, is develop that map and reasons to trust that that's true. And part of that is look back. Look at what God has done in the past with respect to Israel, where he has brought us. And then also look at what kind of God he is. Look at the record of what kind of God he is. And both of those support the map that I am laying out here.
And that relates to my question, comment 26. As I was going through here, I was trying to kind of mesh this with what I was suggesting in Revelation and how that fits.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like some of this describes what Revelation calls the millennium. Some of this seems to describe what's going to happen at the end of the millennium, and actually the final judgment and the end of, like, the destruction of evil and all that happens after the millennium.
Right.
So I think this is consistent with what you've proposed early on in Isaiah, and my question is whether that this is consistent. Is reading it that way, since his concern is the map, and his concern about the map is not every little inlet in the coastline, but is just where the coastline is ultimately headed,
mm-hmm.
he looks into the future and he sees aspects of the millennium, aspects of the final judgment. That's what he describes, never mind what happens between. That you may have some things happen in between that are not part of the description of the end point of all this stuff, because that's not his concern.
Right.
Is that consistent with what
you're saying? Yes, that's the picture that's emerging for me. He doesn't care about those things. And so he doesn't care about times when the coastline is going east and west, or even if it's going north, he doesn't care.
Okay.
He's just describing this coastline that's headed south.
Because the reason that's important here is that Isaiah 26, it presents a picture, the enemies of God are going to be killed, Israel is going to be killed. The big difference is the righteous in Israel who are killed are going to be raised up from the grave and given life again.
Mm-hmm.
The nations, the ungodly nations who are killed are going to stay in the grave.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's no judgment there. There's no resurrection from the dead, what in Revelation was the second resurrection. That's not in Isaiah 26.
Mm-hmm.
And then any punishment that God might give them is not in Isaiah 26. And so the question is, does Isaiah 26 contradict the picture of Revelation and our general idea that people are going to be raised to judgment? Is Isaiah 26 in contradiction to that? Or is it compatible with that? And it seems to me that it can be compatible with that if we recognize that he's not giving us every little last detail of what's going to happen. What's important to him is, in the final analysis, there is no everlasting eternal life for the wicked, but there is for the righteous.
Right. I think that's right. Okay. Thanks.